Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 17th, 2006. Today's session is a forum entitled Competition in Society, moderated by Paul Olson, number FO2006-07. Let's listen in.
And I'm the teaching staff coordinator for the summer, along with my wife, Jeannie, who just rang the bell. And we know people will trickle in with their ice cream and popcorn.
And some of us may leave to go get ice cream, but it's not because we don't like it. We're just going to come back.
Okay. Anybody else has that permission?
Yeah, you can leave if you don't like it, too.
And
you
don't have to. The if you're new to Holden, forums are a long tradition. We have another one on Thursday on anti-racism. And it's your show. We've got some people up front who have some expertise in tonight's topic, in different dimensions of that topic of competition. But we'll just have a night of sharing thoughts, ideas, questions, and go from there. I'm a track coach, and I'm involved in competition every weekend. And the T-shirt that every kid gets when they begin with us is, the goal is the journey. And it changes the nature of competition if the goal is the journey as opposed to getting to the national meet and so on. I just mentioned that by way of introduction, that we have competition in just about every dimension of our culture. And that's what these men will speak to, and you guys will share. And we'll start off with them. They'll introduce themselves and tell us a little bit about where you're coming from with competition. And we'll open the floor to you folks. Another tradition of Holden is we stop sharp at 9:45 for a couple of reasons. Some people will want to be done. Other people will want to continue the conversation throughout the village, and we really encourage that. And so that's another way to kind of extend the thoughts that go on tonight. With that said, welcome to the forum, and we're rolling. You want to start us? Tell us who you are, John?
Oh, I'm John Wallace. We're all men. We didn't plan it that way.
We didn't.
We didn't have much say in it, actually.
Yeah,
we just kind of born this way.
So we were talking about competition. I'm talking about some stuff this week about economic development and about how societies are structured. And one of the themes that I'm going to be talking about by the end of the week is how you get a society structured by social order is provided by competition as opposed to by what economists call rent creation, by limiting, by privilege. Right? And so economists are famous for their focus on competition. The notion that free markets with competitive markets produce good social outcomes, which some people really don't like, that idea. Some people really love it, and you know, I'm kind of in the middle on that one. I got libertarians over here, and I got Marxists over here, you know, about that kind of stuff. And so what I want to talk about, emphasize, and since I'm already almost done with my 2 minutes, is that one of the things that economists are interested in competition about is entry. Okay. So when we think about equality and egalitarianism, right? One of the things we really mean is that everybody has a chance. And a competitive society, in a social sense, is defined by entry and access. That's a word I'm going to use a lot this week. So that when we talk about the benefits of competition, we're talking about a society in which there's access, in which people can compete. And it's not so much the competition that's important, although that plays a role. If you want to start a new business, or you want to have a new rock band, or you want to do whatever, can you do better or worse than the people that are actually doing it? But what it really, the beneficial aspect of this is the entry and access, that you can't have competition unless people can compete.
You done?
I'm done. Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. Sorry. I know it sounded like there was more, but that's about all I had to say.
Yeah, it's a paralinguistic cue.
That's right.
So my name is Jeff Kersengrip, and I'm here teaching intercultural communication this week. And one of the things that's true about people who do intercultural communication well is that they approach the whole thing with a cooperative rather than competitive mindset. And one of the things about being an American is that we tend to approach things with a competitive rather than a cooperative mindset. So to do that sort of thing well, instead of relying on, say, force and violence, we tend to, we're swimming upstream to start with. I found this article a couple years ago. I really like it. I wanted to read you a little piece of it, just from the Los Angeles Times. Remember when Lance Armstrong was knocked off his bike by somebody had a plastic bag and the handle stuck out and accidentally caught his handlebar and dumped him? When Lance Armstrong was dropped to the ground by the wayward handle of a fan's yellow bag Monday, his closest pursuers, even Germany's Jan Ulrich, who had trailed Armstrong by only 15 seconds at the day's start, slowed to wait for Armstrong to pick himself up and get back in the race. To many U.S. sports fans, casual watchers of this most extraordinary race, the Tour de France, what happened in Monday's Stage 15 caused a collective, huh? But to Ulrich, who is 1 minute, 7 seconds behind Armstrong now, speeding off while Armstrong was on the ground would have been wrong. Of course I would wait, Ulrich said Tuesday. If I would have won this race by taking advantage of someone's bad luck, then the race was not worth winning. No one takes advantage of feeding time. And I contrasted this with, just in my mind, reading some of the stuff on the sports page about athletes doing whatever they can to get away with, whatever they can get away with so that they can win. So that, you know, any means to that particular end, not any means, but we tend to push that boundary more in our culture, it seems. There's a book in the bookstore that I'll push for you. It's the only book I asked them to order. Ironically, it has nothing to do with intercultural communication per se, but it's by Alfie Cohn, who's a social psychologist and educational psychologist, really concerned with how we're teaching kids. And it's called No Contest, The Case Against Competition. And he lays out what he says are four myths associated with competition, examines what he says is a comprehensive view of the research on competition, and in his mind debunks all four of the myths about competition. Those being that competition is human nature, that it's something we do because we can't help it, that it leads to better relationships, and there are a couple others. But that he's taking on this idea that to be American, we have to not only learn to compete, but that we are taught to believe in competing. So it becomes what he describes as our civil religion. Others describe it as America's cultural addiction to competition, and that we justify it by claiming it's natural and human. And that it's got enough of a downside to it that he's raising what I think is a good question, one worth considering. So he's not treating it at a macro level like this guy is. He's thinking of it more at a micro level, both intentional competition, what I want to do, and also structural competition, what I'm constrained and enabled to do by the structures that are around me. And again, his emphasis is really on how we teach kids. He says we're at a contest to do most anything. I mean, people are on TV now seeing who can eat the most bugs. I mean, this is that's the sign of somebody who likes to compete. And you can jazz up almost anything in class, I know, we all know from experience, by making it into a little bit of a contest, even if that's irrelevant to what's going on. So that's a voice heard from the other side of things, and more at more of a micro level. And I think the question I'd love to consider tonight is, when is it appropriate for Christians to compete? You know, not is competition healthy or unhealthy, but when should we do it, especially as this particular kind of citizen? I'm done.
Great, thank you. My name is Steve Balls. I'm talking this week about corporate responsibility with an international focus, and what we can do as individuals to encourage corporations to become responsible, whether we are shareholders, consumers, business managers, or members of the public. When I think about competition, a couple of thoughts come to mind. One was an experience that I had 12 years ago. I was asked in 1994 to be a visiting faculty member on short-term assignment at the Shanghai High People's Court in Shanghai, China. The assignment was to talk about competition law. China, of course, was in the transition from a command and control economy to a market economy. At that point, I was a law school dean and jumped at the chance. Incidentally, I was the law school dean of the only ELCA law school in the country. How many people know what that is? That's our problem. Yes?
No.
What is it?
Capital.
Capital University in Columbus, Ohio. As I talked to the judges who were very curious about competition, I shared my philosophy with them that economic competition has tremendous potential. Tremendous potential for better quality of products. Tremendous potential for raising the standard of living. Tremendous potential for allowing those who are on the outside economically to become insiders economically. But there are tremendous downsides also. I talked to them about competition being a very powerful force, but a force that needs to be harnessed. And as they move from an economy without much market competition to an economy with market competition, they need to ask themselves, is Adam Smith's invisible hand of maximizing wealth enough? or was Darwin right, that competition would involve survival of the fittest? I got to visit China 4 years ago, and then last year, both were right. It did maximize wealth. It is amazing the quality of goods and services over there compared to a dozen years ago. The standard of living, although it is the survival of the fittest. You see more social problems. You see people falling through the safety net. So I advise the judges that the role of the law is to harness a competition and to harness it in a way that not too many people fall through the net. As many of you know, I'm a lawyer, and in addition to my current post, I became a lawyer in part because of my fifth grade Sunday school teacher, who was a lawyer. That was the Vietnam time period, and he was the only one that could talk about Vietnam, I thought, in a way that was kind of very analytical and not so emotional. And he said, I became a lawyer because of Micah 6:8, do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God. Where does competition fall into that? Competition speaks, I think, more to justice than anything else. I'm not sure competition speaks much to mercy or speaks much to being humble. But it does speak to justice. If you're clever in competition, you can get ahead. If you develop a better product, you can get ahead. If you can develop a product at a cheaper rate, you can get ahead. But it says nothing about mercy. Those people who fall through the net, those people who do not have the natural gifts or inclination. And it says nothing about being humble. I would observe that many of the people who are the best competitors are the most humble people I know. Many of the people who are the best competitors are the least humble people that I know also. In the sessions that I've talked about this week, we'll be talking about how we can combine competition, the justice of competition, with mercy through an evolving global standard of corporate responsibility where competition can thrive, but at the same time create a safety net to better the lives of all individuals.
Great. You've heard a lot of different dimensions, and it's your turn to share your ideas about competition or to ask your fellow community members here whatever thoughts are on your mind.
Well, someone talked about the corporate or the, instead of competition, you cooperate together to get to a goal. I know my son experienced that at the aerospace engineering degree at the University of Texas, where the group of guys, there were about 11 of them, would get together and study and not compete against each other, but to help each other grow through a program and help each other out as someone not fell behind, but in the studying like they did, it was like something has to suffer while you're doing other classes. It seems like with everyone, I mean, the ones that are MIT now and at grad school, doctorate programs, one part of their studies at any given point suffered throughout the aerospace engineering degree. And they would stay up till midnight, and they would pick groups like Seth and Coy and Howmiao. They were good at one area. They would go over to one person and tutor them on this. And they had groups together who were good in the different areas of thrust, of vibration, all through the aerospace engineering program, and it seemed that there wasn't competition, but a community there at the University of Texas. And also I hear about in the business school, was no one wanted to help each other because they're going to be up higher on the ladder to get into grad school, or they're going to be higher on the ladder to get the first job on the market. And so I saw in university both types, a cooperative and a competition. And I think the aerospace program won out. Because of the 11 have jobs and turned down five or six each. And it helped my son through. My son made the highest grade in labs, but won the lowest grade on tests. And so the guys who he trained in labs took him and trained it on tests. He ended up graduating with a 3.6. After it was amazing how they worked together without stabbing each other in the back, without feeling they had to compete against each other.
Does that perhaps address some things you think about in education, in our process?
Well, there are two. There are three motivations that students supposedly have. And you can have more than one of them, but the one that our schooling is best at that creating is called a performance or an ego orientation, where you'll learn if it helps you impress the teacher, but you'll do other things if it'll help you impress the teacher too, that learning is kind of incidental to that, and that a lot of what goes on in school. Cohen has a great example in the book of when teacher asks a question and all the kids go, oh, and as soon as the teacher calls on somebody, all the rest of them go, ah. You know, and what are they hoping for? They're hoping that the first kid gets it wrong, so that they get to go, you know, me, I know, you know, and that we're schooling that really early, like only one person gets to stand out. And if somebody else gets to come in with the right answer, you know, like, you know, somebody knows, and, you know, Boris, can you tell Natasha how to do it? And Boris can do that, and Natasha's devastated. I mean, many cultures in the world would see that as just insufferably cruel to have wanted to do that, to have jumped in to do that. So there's a performance orientation. There's a work avoidance orientation, which is the fly just low enough to stay off the teacher's trouble radar motivation. And then there's a motivation which all of us love in our classrooms called task mastery, where you have people there who are genuinely interested in new ideas and learning stuff. And they don't really, they work hard to learn stuff instead of working hard to get a high grade. That's different. And they aren't very interested in how well their classmates are doing relative to them. So these three motivations, it sounds like they found a system that worked for them. That managed to do some of both, some task mastery and also some performance things that they needed to do to succeed in the program.
You know, surveys of employers show that one of the top five characteristics that employers desire in college graduates who they think will be leaders are the ability to work as a team. But, you know, I think part of that is the ability to work as a team within this business so we can clobber our competitors.
Oh, I was wondering if you could touch on the idea of leveling schools, because it's something which has been coming back a little bit in, you know, application and tests. You can test into higher classes, but
is that what you mean by leveling?
Yeah, leveling classes in terms of skill level. And I'm wondering, do you think that helps the learning process? It's kind of a competitive thing.
This is the first I've heard of it.
Or, really? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just been coming back, and my mom said that that's how she did it. Throughout our school, like
as
every year.
As opposed to ability group, you mean we're
yeah, like you could can apply to get into a higher level English class, and I know that I did that. Instead of, you know, reading the book in class, you'd read it at home and have class discussion, mm-hmm. and write your essays at home, and you'd spend a lot more time getting deeper into, you know, like Bloom's taxonomy, getting down to the very lowest level of that.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you like this idea.
Well, I really liked it, but they're trying to phase it out at my school. They brought it back in, but a lot of parents are offended. Because they feel that their kids aren't getting the opportunities then. And I'm wondering if the highest level kids are suffering at being put at the level of the median or just below the median so that you can teach the mass amount of students, is that fair to everyone?
Good question.
Well, it sounds like you're a teacher.
It does sound like I'm a teacher.
So I'm wondering if you could speak to that.
I don't have any expertise or experience. I mean,
okay.
I bet somebody else here would, though.
I don't know. I think it's wrong. I think that schools, you should. And I think that if you feel that you're in the wrong class, you should have the chance to test into a higher class, but that it's not the school's job to try to fit everyone into the certain frame of teaching.
I know as a teacher, it's hard to teach people who really don't want to be there for whatever reason, and it can really change the whole culture of the classroom. That sounds like one big reason why people wouldn't want to be there. Is that they feel like, you know, I'm ready for something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Simon, I think that's partly the whole AP thing in high school, and mm-hmm. then the idea of gifted and talent education, you know, that there's both ends of the spectrum. You put a whole lot of effort into trying to work with the kids who have various physical or educational handicaps, disabilities or whatever, and then at the other end, if your brain is eager to do all kinds of stuff, and it's like, you know, my son used to get into a math class, look at the back of the book to see what they're going to be learning. It's like, okay, that means I already know that. So like, here's this whole year with nothing to learn, you know? And so I would agree with you that we need to allow people to learn at the level that excites them. A lot of times, I think I heard a teacher say one time that if you give options on an exam, okay, let's say it's an essay exam or a paper, an assignment of some kind, okay, and you give like four options, one right on one of the four, okay, and one of them's just pretty basic, it's like, that's easy, and they're sort of increasingly more complex, that students will choose the assignment that is most appropriate for them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so someone like you might take the hardest one because you think it's an interesting question, whereas someone who's like, why would I want to do that when I can do this easy one, you know? So, but I guess I, you know, doing the whole class, I disagree with you. It's a good idea to have several options so that everybody can learn at their level.
Well, to me, it just seems sad that we spend. I mean, it's a really good thing, but ever since like preschool and kindergarten, there's been whole separate classes. Or time during class spent for kids who have learning disabilities, and it almost seems unfair that it isn't completely leveled, and that kids who understand the concepts aren't given the opportunities to go farther until the last couple years of high school.
Yeah.
You know, that's 10 years of schooling, which is not really used to the full potential.
Yeah.
Well, I think I didn't see that hand, so I'm sorry.
Well, I had a question about competition, coming from the restaurant business where it's just a fact of life. I mean, you can say that everyone should be able to succeed, but 90% of the restaurants that open this year won't be around in 2 years.
Right.
And there are all kinds of reasons for it, but coming back to Holden Village after many years and realizing that Holden Village was pretty unique years ago. There weren't that many retreat centers. Now every Bible camp is a retreat center. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot easier to get to those retreat centers than it is to Holden Village. It doesn't cost as much to get there. Whereas if we don't realize that at Holden Village, if we say, well, we're the best no matter what, and you can take it or leave it, a lot of people leave it. And they have been leaving it. And the homes are getting smaller every year. And now, does that mean we need a healthy dose of competition? I just want to ask that.
Well, it sounds like this is one of those situations where you would say, this is when Christians should compete. You know?
Well, we are competing.
We are competing. We've got the competition.
But, I think I'm just trying to keep track. So we had a hand there first, or were you following up on that, or?
I'm just scratching my head.
Okay. If you're responding to the person that goes before, we want to follow up that.
I think the issue is, you know, I apologize upfront for this being somewhat incoherent, but I struggle with the you mentioned where mercy lies in the face of competitions, and my experience in at least in the business world is that competition isn't so much about beating your competitors as it is beating yourself, making yourself better than you were, and that most business people would be more than happy if the market grew, and if they could grow the market and everybody could succeed. Businessmen are notorious for their cooperative efforts, right? And they need to go find work. I mean, it's all about networking and helping your friends and meeting people that you can help refer so that somebody who may or may not be a competitor can have an asset that helps them.
Chamber of Commerce is built on that.
Right. And maybe the issue isn't that Holden shouldn't look at the declining population as an issue of it's not competing in a world where there's a finite number of people going on retreats. Maybe the right answer is to be looking to increase the number of people going on retreats and be full with that. It's that the issue of competition having negative consequences only really arises when you think about it in terms of a finite market share or a finite market. And the beauty about
on economic competition is that it creates market. It makes more. And that's a good thing. There's a place for competition, and there are negative aspects if you think about it as competition for scarce resources, but you think about it as better performance, it's a thing of bounty.
James, right behind us here.
Paul, remember you said 90% of restaurants go out of business in 2 years. That sounds familiar with businesses in general.
A lot of businesses around, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I'm doing a thing with a colleague of mine where I'm trying to figure out about entry and access, like I was talking about. And so a friend of mine was the chief economist at the Bureau of the Census, and he works with the Census of Manufacturing. So one thing that economists are trying to do, and you can only do this with really big computers, is to match up all the individual firms with all their employees. Okay, so who works at what firm, how much wages do they pay, what happens, to try to see, they're really interested in productivity over, you know, when the economy is becoming more productive, which produces lots of economic growth, is it because new firms enter that are more productive, or the least productive firms fall out, or whatever. And so what they've done this for America, they've extended it to now to a bunch of places in the world. And what they find is everywhere in the world, the 90% rule, that there's what they call churning, that most of the firms that appear are really small, and most of the firms that disappear are really small. Right? That there's just lots of entry and exit in small firms. And if you're in Peru, it's single guys selling t-shirts or burritos or whatever on the street. I mean, and it doesn't matter what economy you're in, there's lots of things. But what happens is that economies are really different in what happens when you're successful. In America, Google goes from being two guys, and literally Sergey Brin lived just behind Ellen. So he's worth $5 billion now. He grew up in the neighborhood. So he was at our elementary school 15 years ago, and now he's worth all this stuff. And in Europe, it turns out, you're talking about the labor laws, that there's no firms between 15 and 100. Because the labor laws all kick in at 15. So you have to provide insurance for your employees. You have to do all this stuff. So most Italian firms have 13. That's the Italian one. The guy who was finding some time. And then if you don't get bigger, so you jump to 100. So in Europe, if you want to compete, you compete at 100. You don't compete at the little ones and get bigger. And in developing countries, or non-developing countries, however we talk about it, what happens is that there's no jumping. That there's all these little firms going in and out of business, and that firms that are successful, that get big, start big, because they're connected in with the political parties, or they're connected in with the banks, or they're connected in with the existing structure. So that they vary in their degree of competition, and their competition the way they structure their competition produces these kind of systematic outcomes. So the restaurant business produces really good restaurants because it's very competitive. And they just said, you're going to have a restaurant, and you can't close it, and you get to have the only restaurant in town, the food probably wouldn't be as good, right? And so places that are allow competition, which means allowing failure, in some sense, along the way, tend to do better than places that have small competition, but when it comes to actually coming into business at a meaningful scale, don't let you do it, don't do as well.
Well, I was just gonna respond back to you about the climbing at Holden and such, and one of the barriers could have been the food, but if the word gets out that the food is now, well, then that could be a whole different story.
I'd say, too, that notion of beating ourselves, that one of the points Cohn makes is that competition is like kissing, is it's fundamentally a relational act. It's not something you do with yourself. That's a semantic trick. When we say I'm competing with myself to raise, I'm going to lift 10 more pounds today than yesterday, that's not really competition. You're just exceeding a standard you set for yourself. But to call that competition kind of muddies the water. I thought that was kind of interesting, that analogy. I like that. It's like kissing.
Has Holden improved because of the competition or changed?
We don't know yet. Too early to tell, but I think probably it has. I if Holden realizes that there are other people out there who are also striving and succeeding to make a ministry of a retreat center, that actually helps Holden.
I think we had a hand right there. Did you have a hand? Okay, and then one, two, cut that way.
I work in the field of collaboration, and if you look at collaboration as an approach and competition as an approach, I guess fairly, that maybe it depends on the outcome we're looking for in any given situation as to what tool to apply or what approach to apply. I guess I'd be interested to hear what, you know, what other approaches. I mean, you know, collaboration, there's competition, there's probably other approaches to get different outcomes.
Individualism.
And yeah, and applying those different, like what, which of those approaches work better or worse in different situations, I think might be, I would be interested to hear from you on.
Cohen talks about some of that in his book, but I don't have it in my head. He analyzes mostly educational research to see what kinds of learning tasks produce what kinds of outcomes. Competitive is outdone by cooperative in virtually every arena of actual mastery of new ideas. Individualism pops in there for some things, but I couldn't tell you what they are. But competition is a pretty poor pedagogical strategy often.
I actually read the first two chapters of Cohen's book this morning. So it has something called MEGA, mutually exclusive
goal attainment.
Okay.
Mutually exclusive
goal attainment.
If I win, you lose.
Right. So,
we start to resent the people work.
Yeah. So there's some there are some semantic issues here with what we mean by competing, and what we mean by competition. So Cohen is very clearly defining a competitive environment as an environment in which there can only be one winner. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that participating in the process means that there will be a winner and there will be one or more losers. Okay. Now, what Paul's talking about, you know, that the goal is the journey, right? In a race, there's going to be one winner, and that's a mega setup. But in the process, it's not necessarily, right? So that when we look at, I'm going to talk about this some this week, that when it doesn't matter what you're doing in this world, you don't do it alone. And even if you're Pavarotti, if you're a solo singer, you don't do it by yourself, right? Nothing productive in our society is done by individuals acting alone, or so small a part of it that it's collaboration and cooperation, right? So that we cooperate together in groups. And part of what I think Jeff is getting at and Cohen's book is about is then how, if we know that we have to cooperate, how do we mix how much cooperation we do in groups with competition for the things that we're doing? Because if we dictate outcomes, we don't have competition, right? If we say this is what everybody's going to do, we don't have access and entry and allowing people to choose what they're going to do, right? So we have this. So I think there's several kind of semantic things here. Whether we're talking about competition as being the process of competing, in which there may be multiple winners, right, and multiple people will come out. And in fact, the way they compete is through mastering cooperative processes. Because what the business school teaches you is do not go it alone. If you want to be successful, you got to learn to work together, which is really hard for the business school students because they select people who want to make a lot of money. I was in economics, the undergraduate advisor in the economics department, and the worst students in the world were the business students who were complaining about their economics grade because they wanted to succeed. But what they were being told is you got to cooperate. You know, so how these things are can be thought of as polar extremes. There's competition or cooperation, and in fact, the way Cohen cleverly and rhetorically sets it up, there's only one or the other because of the way he defines competition. You can have competition or cooperation. You can't have both. But in fact, I think in the world that we live in, there's a mix of them. You know, and we want to see how, we, you know, is there better ways and worse ways to put that together? I mean, what Steve's talking about with these corporate goals, do we want to ask these competitive corporations to cooperate on certain dimensions and not others? What are the best dimensions for doing that?
Even Darwin talked about survival of the fittest had a lot more to do with cooperation than with competition. Mm-hmm. That when species are in competition, that's so rare, and it happens so seldom that it had a lot more to do. You survived because you managed to work together. You didn't go it alone. And right. that somehow the survival of the fittest thing has come to be associated more with competition than cooperation. And that's not, the historical record doesn't bear that out.
I think Jane was next, and then Simon, on this.
That was two things to say. One was with regard to Holden Village. I think there's a, you talk about niche marketing, whether in any kind of, like in retailing, you can decide whether you're going to try to beat Walmart on prices. Well, no, we're going to compete on a different level. And I think for Holden, you're not going to compete on accessibility, but there's no other community like this one, you know. And so in that sense, it's like, we're doing some niche marketing here. I think the other thing to I recently wrote a piece for the QC magazine about arts organizations and competition and collaboration. I looked at some of the in nature, the species, the different survival strategies, competition in the sense of course, the food chain, or even plants like the walnut tree that exudes a kind of a chemical that other plants can't grow underneath it or nearby it. And then there's a symbiosis where you have different species working, doing things that benefit each other. And I was comparing that to arts organizations in our area. You know, we've got a symphony, we've got a ballet, we've got a theaters, we've got museums, all of whom are competing in a sense for the same audience, which is not unlimited in our area, and also for the same funding, you know, and to what extent. And I talked about some of the groups that are actually cooperating with each other. So the symphony playing for the ballet, or the ballet dancing for the symphony, rather, or a other situations where you have tapping into each other's audiences, sharing audiences in that sense, with the hope of perhaps if someone's interested in this kind of arts, that they would also perhaps be willing to take in this one. It's a case, I think, of both competing and cooperating a little bit, and hoping that everybody thrives.
I think I'm just keeping track of the order of hands. Is right behind Simon. I can't even see what.
Sounds like we're using the word competition for a couple of different kinds of things. Mm-hmm. One is winner take all.
Okay.
And I think in that kind of competition, people assess their own capability, whether it's a restaurant or a retreat center or someone running a race, and they figure out if they even have a chance of doing it. I think the real difficulties with the kind of unethical behaviors that can come about in competition occur not so much in that kind of competition, but in the kind of competition where a certain number of people are going to receive some privilege. And they're all going to compete on some basis. They don't know exactly how many are going to get that privilege, or they don't exactly know what the cutoff is. But only a certain number of people are going to get fellowships to go into that particular graduate program. Or only a certain number are going to be accepted into law school. Or only some number of restaurants are going to survive. And I think it's in those situations where things are sufficiently ambiguous that people begin to game the system and try to figure out what combination of actual skill and ability or unethical behavior might put them in the range to be in the group that gets selected. And I'm just putting that theory out and clarifying the kind of competition that I think that fits with.
One of Cohen's points is related to whether the behavior you're describing, the unethical stuff, whether that's a corruption of competition or its consummation.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's, is cheating the logical endpoint of competition. If we had a chance to take advantage of other retreat centers without them knowing, would we do it? Is that an essence of, succeeding at the competition game, or is that a corruption of what competition is really all about?
what I'm trying to do here is just call on people who haven't spoken, and so, and Vernon.
I just have a question about, so if people don't make it alone in the business world or anything else, why have we been led to believe that that's how it's done? What's that about? I mean, why do we carry this myth that the individual can make it alone?
Help. No, there's a. I think about law. Okay, we think about the development of rule of law as being something that's very important in America, in the United States, but in many countries, European countries now, and in some places in the world, we define rights in terms of things that individuals possess, right? And so the individuals have rights. But in history, that was rarely the case. I'm actually gonna talk a little bit about this tomorrow with the Popes and what they decided to do, that organizations had rights. and if you were in colonial America and you went to court, as the head of your household, not as John Doe. I mean, there might be some activities in which you as an individual are there. So that your position in society determined what rights you had. And part of opening competition up required societies getting past that. Okay? That everybody could do something. And this is what I was trying to stress was about entry as opposed to winning. The competition is about entry. It's about letting people in. And that meant that people had to have the right to compete as individuals. Now what happened then is very interesting in corporate law, Steve can talk about this, is that corporations were originally defined as organizations that had lots of privileges, they had special privileges. And then the transformation that occurs in American law in the later part of the 19th century is that corporations acquire personality. They become like people at law. So that General Motors is like you or me. Well, obviously, they're not quite like you and me because they got all these people. But that we treat them like a person, just like we treat everybody. Okay? And entry into competition requires that we treat everybody the same. Right? And so we treat General Motors like we treat me, because that's the only way we can structure a competitive system in which everybody can enter. And so we have a very strong in Western tradition, and particularly the Whig tradition that America's formed in, of a notion of individual rights and that individuals move forward, which in fact is the way in which we brought in this entry into organizations, this powerful ability to participate in organizations that was limited to a few people for most of human society and has now been open to everybody.
You know, I do think when I talk about harnessing competition, I think it's a tremendous force, competition for good, but it needs to be harnessed because people cannot make it alone. Many people cannot make it alone. That is why, even in a capitalistic system, we need substantial regulation competition. We need strong laws, in my opinion, protecting labor unions, strong antitrust laws, strong unfair competition laws. And then a strong safety net also for people who can't make it within labor unions or within the framework of the law. Competition has tremendous potential, but it's a tool, not an end of itself, and it's a tool to be managed.
I'd offer too, Cohen, one of the summary claims he makes after looking at cross-cultural data about competitiveness in societies, one of the findings is there's a remarkable correspondence between competitiveness in a society and the presence of clearly defined have and have-not groups, so that the more competitive the groups are, the more polarized the income actually gets distributed in those societies, as a maybe an outcome measure of some of the same intentions that you're describing about that's supposed to come from competition. Just a claim made. He also claims that competitive societies tend to hurry their children toward adulthood. Just looking at demographic data, what happens to people in those societies, and back to the question of when should Christians compete, I don't see either of those as especially things that I want to push for as a liberal Christian.
I'm not directing this, but boy, I just heard it's a tool, not an end, from Steve. That's a pretty interesting concept, I think, to think about here. I think, Ron, you're up next.
I would, a lot of the research recently on high school graduates and college graduates, because of how organized they've lived their lives, or you said, kind of pushed them through adulthood, are unable to do complex problem solving. And neurologists, I took one through our community on the east side of Tacoma from UW Tacoma recently. And I had them walk through the community, and I had them stop and be quiet. And I asked them to listen.
Do you mind defining your community just a little bit? A lot of folks know
you. The community is a very diverse, low income,
yeah.
Not competitive.
Good.
They're cooperative, though.
Yeah.
The kind of folks.
Thank you.
In a housing project in East Tacoma. This is what she said. This is what the professor of neurology said. She was quiet until she did this. It would be like sitting here quiet during the day when Narnia walks through. And they heard all these kids playing. There was not one organized sport going on. And I said, look at that. And it was there, all the ethnic racial groups, all mixed in, playing in this goofy little place where our little Holden kids came. I even have a picture of them at the school, our little four elementary kids with these very diverse racial groups. She said this. Now, I don't know this. I don't know this to be true. I just want to bring this up. She said, do you know what's going on in brain research now? I said, no. I don't want to know. I don't want to think more about my brain. And she said, this is amazing. That these kids are playing, not organized into soccer, baseball, football, on and on from kindergarten on. And that they are actually learning how to solve complex relationships, conflict, and everything else. Now that's not, she wasn't talking about an idealized community. Simply that I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and at the age of 63, all my friends who had no fathers, finally, who grew up in a very diverse thing, every one of us managed to succeed through incredible things. One is a millionaire, the Sahadis, the other is a Westchester, flies a helicopter at his age still, and he's a St. Olaf grad who was thrown out of St. Olaf when he rode his motorcycle on and said, Silverman's last ride. And I say that to you because you didn't follow the rules. We didn't have rules. We played the way we were going to play. And we were able to figure out a bunch of stuff that I'm with people that cannot figure things out. Like the simplest thing, like a bill that you get at your restaurant, and they can't figure out what you're supposed to tip them. From that kind of complaint, they don't even have the ability. And it was up to like 30% for college graduates, and it was like 75% for high school graduates. And I would ask the question, what has an organization done to competitive cooperative understandings of community building, which I see at Holden is phenomenal as a community where joy predominates in work? And I would only ask another question then, has anyone read Bakke's book, The Joy of Work? Because he's from here. Ray Bakke, the theologian, Lowell Bakke, the Baptist pastor, and then Dennis, who was one of the richest men in the world at one time until stocks collapsed, who used assets-based community development to run a business. And Harvard and the big school down in California wrote articles on how could you do this? How could you run a restaurant the way you did, by the way, or you three? It doesn't make sense in the world of competition or even cooperation without competition. It wouldn't make sense. That's a lot. I just want the organized, though.
That was a very precise question. I'm just not sure which of the 12 points.
I didn't know what's that point. It wasn't even a question, was it?
It's a statement. That's okay. It's a forum. We can talk, do whatever we want.
Yeah. Ron's question triggered something in my mind. I'm a sports fan, and I love competition within the lines of a game.
and I love soccer because there's 17 rules, and the final decider is the referee based on if he decided whether the cheating gave an advantage or not. That didn't you go on. But then outside of that realm, one of the things I like is because everyone, the idea is that everyone is on the same playing field. And as Verlana asked this question, I was thinking we hold poor people in this country to a higher standard. We expect them to compete individually. So we organize food stamps and welfare checks and whether or not you get housing if you need to have help getting housing. Whether or not you are punished or benefit from being married to the father of your children, all around an expectation you individually should solve this problem of your poverty. Yet, the best business schools, the best business students all understand that they make it as a team. You do a search at HarvardBusinessReview.com, and team performance is the biggest set of articles with the best sellers in terms of buying the ones that people will, those of us who are too cheap to subscribe that buy arguments, buy are all on team performance. And it just seems to me that we've set up a society that has used competition to make those of us who are doing fine feel well. And because we did it as a team and with others, and we know that our parents helped us, and our neighbors helped us, and our classmates helped us, and we're doing fine because we work well with others. And then apply an entirely much higher, much more difficult standard to poor people and say, you have to do this entirely individually. And if somebody, if you're poor, and we're giving you food stamps and some child care so you can have a job, and somebody moves into your apartment, which would be a normal thing for a couple of college students to do to save some money, but we're going to punish you because now your rent's going up. And I just wanted to put that out there, that I think in this society we've used competition very perversely in terms of public policy, but I think a lot of us also have felt okay about that because it makes us feel like we did it the right way.
See, that's what Jeff was talking about. You said this the other day, was about this discourse of competition, that we have a language of competition, which and I think we're on, which is not quite consistent with the reality of how the system works. Right? We have a focus on individuals, even though I think there are reasons why we have that, but that in fact we are more productive when we cooperate. And so we don't really have a language to describe the world that we live in. I mean, it isn't like we're lying about it, it's just that we don't know how to do it. And it does, and I think you're right, it really causes problems when we try to address problems for which our language is not well suited.
It's upsetting to us too, I think, to realize that I might be inconsistent with my own values, you know? And so I come up with other narratives that help me reconcile what I'm letting go on in my name. And that one of the stories is I don't look at the reality you just pointed out, Ron. You know, I ignore that one so that I can live with how I'm benefiting from the way things are.
Thank you for that. And one and two, and we're getting to the end, so we'll take a couple more.
I just wanted to kind of follow up on what was said here. I think there's definitely this American ideal and this American myth that we've already talked about, that, you know, anybody can make it. You know, any guy, if he tries hard enough and wants it enough, can set out a shingle on the street and become a millionaire. And if you work hard enough, you can have it. The contrapositive of that is, if you don't have it in life, you probably haven't worked hard enough. And to me, that's very clearly not true. I will be a senior at Pacific Lutheran University next year. And I'm considering applying to law school.
You didn't go to Hodgsburg?
Pacific Lutheran University, yeah. And I think I'm
standing to me.
That's right. And while I'm proud of what I've done, I think I've worked hard and competed well. I realize that the very fact that I can go there and can compete in that on that level and can compete with pre-law students in and of itself would have been completely impossible without my starting point. And I think the idea of a level playing field gets ignored. You know, we're in America, it's the land of opportunity, anybody can make it. Well, more so than other places, yes. But it's just, I think, immensely important to realize as successful people and as you become successful, yes, you work for what you have, but the variability that you could compete up here rather than down here is a gift, and that's not a competition. So.
So you're worried about the validity of that narrative right now.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, and I don't want to downplay what we have in America, and I do think there is opportunity for entrepreneurship, and that's good. But that narrative, as I said, I think it has a sinister side that allows for apathy. You know, well, we are in the land of opportunity. I'm a millionaire, and this guy's poor on the street. Oh, probably didn't work hard enough. Makes me feel better.
But just observe that the tools of the law will give you a tremendous ability to help start leveling the playing field.
Well, that's hopefully where I want to go.
My session tomorrow, by the way, is going to talk about the U.S. culture. We're going to explore the U.S. cultural iceberg in terms of some of the values and stuff associated with American culture. So if this is a conversation, if the direction this is going right now interests you, you might enjoy talking tomorrow.
I saw one more hand.
Simon.
Yeah, well, I kind of going to go back like 20 minutes and touch on the idea of she was talking about the art world. And I've played in a number of youth symphonies, and the only one that I found to be truly successful and actually growing, and we actually make profit and put it into the music program around us, is one in which we all compete for our chair placements, and we don't treat it as, you know, everyone gets in, and we have a complete kind of really hard-line cut policy. And yet at the same time, it's the only one where I've really made deep connections with the people around me. And so I think it's funny that the reason why these other youth organizations that I've been in disagree with competition is to stop hard feelings, that it doesn't happen when there is competition. And so that leads me to the idea that if somebody wins, does somebody else have to lose? And I don't think so. I mean, if somebody gets principal chair and you were going for that goal, do you automatically lose?
Are you less?
Are you that much less? Does that make you a bad person? And I think the idea that everybody loses when somebody wins is very present. The idea of charity. You know, you're giving away your money, and are you losing something because somebody else is gaining from your goodwill.
Yeah, one point Cohn makes is that the dichotomy, he calls it a false dichotomy between altruism and selfishness, and that he cites a study where the kids who were most empathic were also most likely to stand up for their own beliefs. So it's not that you're either looking out for yourself or you're looking out for other people, but the people who are capable of being other-focused and looking at others and what they need were also more capable of doing that for themselves. It's tangentially related to what you're saying, but it was an interesting dichotomy to have identified as false for me.
Last one.
Well, you know, the more we talk, the more I realize it gets back to fear and scarcity. It seems to make things go round for the haves, you know. I mean, it's just a way to get people to do what you want them to do, you know, if there's a feeling that there's not enough to go around. You have to really work your butt off and beat all these people in order to get something because there's not enough of it, which, you know, seems to be the tactic of the current administration. But it's also it's also just a tactic, you know, that seems to be prevalent, like commercials for everything. All centered around fear and scarcity.
Thank you for that. And thank all of you for lots of different perspectives and encourage you if with any kind of rise in consciousness from your discussion tonight, carry on conversation all over in the Arc, on the hikes. And so thank you for coming. Thank you guys for being part of it.